Welcome to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christian Needon. The first half of this episode features an interview that I did while visiting the Brooklyn home of photographer Kirk Edwards and his wife Siobhan Edwards. Siobhan grew up in Hawaii, steeped in the island's traditional culture and performing the ancient dance known as the hula. Recently, she and Kirk collaborated on creating a black and white photo exhibition that captured beautiful still images of young women who are part of the newest generation of Hawaiian hula dancers. Titled The Hula Project, it opens Saturday, December 10th, 2016, at the North Shore Pipeline Gallery on the Hawaiian island of Oahu, with the show on display from January 2nd to the 15th, 2017. Here's my interview with Kirk and Siobhan Edwards. So, Siobhan, tell me about your experience with hula in your youth.
I was born and raised in Hawaii, so like a lot of kids from grade school, you are sort of immersed in the Hawaiian culture. It's all around us. So you learn about it in school, you learn it from your neighbors, your friends, your family. So I started hula when I was about five. I actually saw the Mary Monarch competition, which is the big hula competition of all the schools or all the halaus all over the entire state, meaning every single island. They put on an annual competition, and I was watching it on TV and just was absolutely mesmerized by the music, by the dance, the flowers, just everything about the performance aspect, not knowing much more than that, being five. My parents took me to see a friend of my mom's. Her name was Kanoi. She was Miss Hawaii back in 1974, so she was still quite a big deal when I was five. And she was a hula dancer at a hotel by the name of the Halekulani. Went there to see her dance live and just fell in love with her. And she sort of took me under her wing and brought me to the school that she actually graduated from. And it was a woman by the name of Auntie Maiki. And so she had a hula halau, and I started taking dance classes and pretty much never stopped. I was starting to perform in Waikiki, in hotels, the shopping malls, at the beach, and then started taking dance in my school. And that's when I was able to start traveling and start sharing the hula with others beyond our island.
Did your friends and classmates also dance hula?
We were all exposed to it. I went to a laboratory school in Hawaii, and the people I went to school with, the teachers that we had, were pretty unique. Although not everyone danced, hula, or Hawaiiana as we called it, was a big part of our curriculum. So we all had to do either Hawaiian crafts, we had to learn Hawaiian language, we had to learn hula. Some of us stuck with the hula. Some others went on to the music and did ukulele. There's quite a few people in my school who actually have gone on to be pretty famous Hawaiian musicians. And some have gone on to be Miss Hawaii. And, you know, so everyone's sort of taken some sort of our culture and have embodied it.
And it seems like this is a big cultural identifier, very deeply ingrained in that. For people who don't know, for Native Hawaiians, what is the importance of the hula to cultural identity?
It's a big part of who we are. I mean, it goes beyond being Hawaiian. I think it just comes, when I say being Hawaiian, that's meaning of actual Hawaiian ethnicity. Being a local or a kama'aina, you know, hula or Hawaiian culture is very much a part of who we are as the people of the islands. Hawaiian food, I should say, for example, is as appreciated as American food. Having kalua pig is as common at Thanksgiving as you would have turkey. So, you know, it's pretty seamless as far as the two worlds. You know, in Hawaii, there's really not much of a differentiation, I guess. It really is who we are.
Tell me about the protectiveness around portrayals of hula and other Hawaiian rituals by those who aren't Native Hawaiians. What are the feelings about that?
Well, we're taught at a very, very young age to respect not just hula, but everything Hawaiian. We are taught to respect our land, you know. We're taught to respect our culture, our food, our music, our dance, even our arts and crafts, you know, from basket weaving to lei making to skirt making to instrument making. We learned all of that as we were kids growing up. And with that came a real profound respect for all of those aspects of our culture, even the food. There was always like a ceremony. I remember in our school, we've even dug an emu and buried the pig and cooked the pig. So we learned what that was all about. We had a garden in our school where we grew taro and breadfruit, and you know, we learned about native plants and really took pride in everything that we had. So hula was just yet another aspect of our culture that we just learned from day one that it was sacred.
As part of being a youth and growing up there, were you exposed to adults that had frustrations about misportrayals?
There's definitely those who I think are a little bit more open to sharing it with others and teaching others. Then there's definitely those who feel that it's theirs to keep and they're very protective of it. And I think you find that with a lot of Native cultures where there's the old school mindset that, you know, this is ours and we need to protect it. And then there's sort of the, I guess, more modern thinking of, you know, the way to keep it alive is by sharing it and by teaching others and teach other people to have that respect. So there's always that conflict. But, you know, having grown up there and not being of Hawaiian ethnicity, I'm more of the modern thinking that, you know, what we have in Hawaii is so amazing and it's so special and so unique. And there's so much that we can teach other people. You know, our culture, it's more than just the Hawaiian culture. It's, you know, we also have it's a fusion of Japanese and Portuguese and Filipino and Chinese. And, you know, we have all of these cultures. We really are truly a melting pot. And, you know, being sort of primarily of immigrants, you know, we've learned to sort of blend and take on one another's cultures and habits and even language and foods and then created our own unique culture as a result. And so, like I said, I come from that mindset where sharing it is only going to bring just greater things. I think we really have a lot to offer. And the more people know, I think the better chance Hawaiian culture and hula and all of our arts and crafts and our foods and all of that have a better chance of really being preserved.
Turning to Kirk, tell me about the evolution with all that in mind of this hula project. What made you want to embark on it?
We decided to do a family vacation to Oahu. So Siobhan hadn't been home in almost 10 years, and it was clear that she was missing it. And so when we decided to go, she was explaining the ohana and the family that you have to go back and see. It was clear that a two-week trip wasn't going to do it, and a week trip or 2 weeks wasn't going to do it. So it ended up being that we were going to go for almost 3 weeks. I'm not the sort of person that can sit on a beach for 3 weeks. And, you know, I spoke with her about trying to do something that was Hawaiian and something that she was passionate about. And I knew that she'd grown up being a hula dancer. So I knew I had to tread lightly because of exactly the questions that you'd been asking about how protective they are about culture. And it was something that we had to approach and plan and, you know, speak with Kanoi and send references and say exactly what we wanted to do and how we were going to be able to achieve it. Even when we landed, we needed to sit down and go out to brunch and meet all the girls and go through everything with them. And it was certainly a process, and it wasn't that we just walked into it and took some pictures. It was a lot of planning. It was spending time with the girls and meeting them and finding out who they are and getting everyone's approval and making sure that we were all on board with what was going to happen and what we were going to show.
Had you ever gone through a process like that for a project in your photographic career?
I always try to approach projects and make people feel comfortable in their environments and you know, try to get people so they feel natural. And I certainly feel like this, more so than any other project, was definitely much more time consuming. It wasn't being hired for a job and flying in and meeting the person, spending a couple hours with them. It was much more immersion, I guess.
How did you go about vetting the girls that were going to be the subjects of the project?
There was some concern, you know, that these photographs were going to be respectful and tasteful, honoring the hula tradition and not really exploiting it, or perhaps showing it in a very stereotypical way. You know, it wasn't easy to find dancers who were willing to be photographed. Like I was telling you, you know, there's a sort of a sacred aspect and a religious aspect to the dance. Your kumuhula is your teacher. Easiest way to sort of explain it, it's sort of like your priest, I guess. And you would go to talk to your priest and get permission from your priest to be able to do, you know, X, Y, and Z. And with the kumuhula, we were running into a lot of problems. We're asking very close friends of mine, you know, if they would be willing to dance and pose for us. And they weren't able to sort of cross their kumuhula. We were lucky enough to find some girls who kind of had the same mentality that I do, which is this is an awesome gift that we have that we would love to share. And there already was, you know, some trust. And I think they felt that their craft, their art was going to be shown in a very respectful and tasteful way. You know, I think that made it a lot easier once you found the subjects that were willing to help out.
What was the strategy? Did you have an idea of size, black and white? Did that come into play? What was the technical strategy for how this show would be hung?
I definitely went over with the aspect of wanting it to be in black and white. I wanted to be able to create some images that sort of felt timeless. And I flew over there with a 4x5 camera and I started shooting everything with Type 55 Polaroid. I wasn't sure if we were going to get one girl or were we going to get four girls, or I had no sort of, you know, we walked into this sort of blind, not knowing exactly who was going to sign on or who was going to say yes and no. And so I thought if we got one girl, that would be a good start. And, you know, we ended up having four or five.
Five.
We had five girls. So, you know, at a certain point, they just kept coming and coming. And so I ended up changing from, because I was by myself with just Siobhan, the 4x5 was a little bit too slow and I was getting so much that I switched over and I started shooting digital. So I wanted to shoot everything on 4x5, but it becomes really hard when it's trading that look for content. And because it was the first sort of thing that we started, I just wanted to get as much coverage as I could. And so I did the wrong thing probably and just started shooting everything digitally. And then I went back in the end and matched everything to where I started. So it was a little bit more time. It wasn't not a lot of post-production per se, but it was definitely getting everything to match the way that I originally wanted to start it.
The final choices that are going to appear in the show, can you tell me about some of the individual ones and what they symbolize?
We sort of covered everything, and there's two types of hula. There's the hula kahiko, which is the old traditional hula,
ancient, yeah.
So the ancient style, which you see with the full grass skirts and with
not a lot of flowers per se. It's a lot more foliage, fern and miley leaf and things of that sort. Much more organic, I guess, if you will.
We also covered the hula awana, which is what you see on Waikiki, which is the
modern,
glittery and a little bit softer. You know, I guess we had a girl who was represented by her heritage as Hawaiian, Tahitian,
Samoan, and Fijian. Yeah.
Wow.
We called her the Poly Diva because she literally was of every Polynesian descent you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, and her grandfather still makes koa canoes, which is a dying art, and her family is about as Hawaiian as you can get. She ended up sort of being the star of the show, and we ended up, I had so much great material with her. And then another girl that with the grass skirt, and the hula kahiko became a lot more interesting in terms of photographically shooting it. And the focus of the project was sort of to focus on the dance. And you're in Hawaii, it's so hard to not take a girl and put her in this beautiful scenery. And I shot everything on white and black. So it's really all about the dance and the girl and the movement and the details. It's removing them from that environment.
The cover photograph for the show removes the face. It's pretty much the midsection of the dancer's body in mid-dance, I believe.
They were dancing the entire time, so it was all mid-dance. Like I said, the whole idea was to focus on the dance and the details of it. And that was how I wanted to go in. And we do have portraits of all the girls, but it's not showing the big picture of the volcanoes in the background and the ocean and the early morning lights and, you know, the dancer being small, which is how sort of hula has always been perceived.
Like Kirk was saying, you know, oftentimes you see the hula and the dancer in a very spelled out sort of context where you've got the beach and the ocean and the palm trees and you can feel the breeze and you probably could smell the flowers. And here he removes the subject from its environment. So you really focus on the power and the strength and the force of nature that the dance and the dancer have. And yet he also shoots the landscapes and the flowers, everything else that is extremely, like we were mentioning earlier, very essential in hula. You can't have one without the other. So the amazing thing about having it in a gallery and seeing this show is that you're able to appreciate and feel the power of the dancer by herself, and you can take a step back and you can enjoy the entire dance by also having the inclusion of the landscapes and the flowers. And so now all of a sudden you're sort of injecting the meaning, the context. And so you can really sort of feel the intensity of the entire art form as a whole. That makes his work so special because you have the ability to do either. You know, you can either enjoy the landscape and really sort of feel what... he has a beautiful shot of wave in pipeline, and it's amazing. I mean, and it's huge. How big is it? It's
13 feet long.
So you're standing there in front of a 13-foot long photograph of this impressive, powerful wave. And so you can stand there and enjoy that and feel that, and then you can take one step over and you'll see a dancer, and you can feel all of that energy rushing through the wave, and then you can see it rushing out of the dancer in the movement. And that, I think, is just so awesome to be able to experience that. And like I said, to share that with people who can stand there and sort of absorb all of that around them. It's pretty cool.
More than just the dance, and because it's hula's so tied in with ceremony, obviously there's an audible component to it. Tell me about that aspect of hula, specifically the chant side.
Hawaiian was not a written language. It was an oral language. History was told from generation to generation. Hula was a visual language, I guess, if you will. Hula is more than just the movement of the hips and batting of the eyes. And it was a way to tell a story. It was a way to recount an event. It was a way to preserve history. Yeah, not a lot of people realized that actually hula was strictly for men in the very beginning. Because it was born out of the gods, and men kind of had the upper hand in that, you know. Seems like sort of a age-old story, no matter what culture you're in. But it was the men who would recount, you know, stories of war or battles. And so the chanting obviously is descriptive of what the dance is, but there is a very strong connection to, again, the spirituality, the religious, the deity. And so it's almost as if people become, we didn't say possessed, but I didn't really like that word. What was we used? Like
enlightened.
Yeah, no, embodied. I think
or
I feel
channeling.
Yeah, it was like they were. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of. Yeah, they would channel. They would be channeling sort of another voice, another spirit of some sort. And one of the girls that we photographed was 17 years old. High school girl, very shy, sort of very striking girl, and yet had a very kind of soft voice. And she mentioned that she was learning to chant and that she'd been studying it for a number of years, and she was amazing. She was open to sharing it with us, and it's I'm kind of excited that Kirk was able to witness it, because it's something that you can't really describe. It's something that you have to experience. This girl closed her eyes and sort of took this deep breath, and her entire posture, her physical state sort of shifted. And then this voice, this booming voice, just kind of erupted out of her from starting. You could tell that it just started from the bottom of her stomach, and it just flowed. It just came out, and it filled the entire space, and it was powerful, and it would just give you chills. And you could tell that she sort of lost herself and was sort of allowing these, her ancestors and these spirits, to kind of come through her. I think that chanting is a perfect example of how sacred hula is, and exactly what it is that the Hawaiians are really wanting to preserve, is that connection, that raw, deep interconnection with our ancestors, with our roots, with which ultimately lead, you know, back down to the gods. The gods are the ones that created our islands and created the flowers and all the vegetation and the waves. And I mean, it's, that is the essence of Hawaii, is are these gods. And so chanting is incredible, because it's really a way to bring all of that back to life. And then you add that with the power and the grace of the dance itself, and now you've got just this incredible spiritual experience, and you honestly feel so connected to the islands. It's like, it's in your head, it's in your bones, it's in your blood, it's in your, you can feel it in your skin, you know, you just, all of that, the hula just touches every, what do you call it, like your senses are just come alive. And I think that's really what is just so special about hula and our music and our history and our instruments. And I think, I mean, it's a little off subject, but while I'm talking about it, I think the beauty of what Kirk was able to capture was that pure and that rawness. You look at these pictures and you can feel the grace, you can feel the elegance, but you can feel the power, and you can feel, you know, the connection. Some of his portraits, you know, the girls are looking you in the camera, but there's, you feel a certain connection, like you, they pull you in, and you feel, even if you're not from Hawaii, even if you're not Hawaiian, you feel connected to them.
People who want to see this, when and where can they find this project?
The show opens at Pipeline Gallery, which is up on the north shore of Oahu, which is not the easiest place to get to if we're here in Brooklyn. But I did want to show it and be able to invite the girls and have all of them be there. And we've heard from all of them, and they are all showing up next Saturday, so that's super important. And I think it was important to be able to share it there first and foremost, versus trying to do a show in New York and just having it feel like it was out of place. So,
did you have a previous relationship with this particular gallery?
No, I flew over to Hawaii and just I printed a whole bunch of 4-foot by 7-foot prints and flew over there and just started knocking on galleries' doors and showing it to people, and I got a really, really good response. You know, they sort of sat in my computer, and it's something I put a little book together, and it's something I've been chipping away on for a couple years. And my cousin sort of gave me a little kick and said, you know, we need to get on a plane and go show some people this. And it's been really, really well received. So, you know, I would love to bring it back to Brooklyn and or bring it back to New York and show people here, but I certainly wanted it to start there, just out of respect for everyone involved. I think that's sort of its home, and that's the first place that people needed to see it.
Well, that's a great thing about Radio Free Brooklyn. We are a streaming service, so anybody with an internet connection can hear this, both live and podcast form. But this is going to be airing first twice ahead of that show, ahead of the opening. So I would encourage all of my Hawaiian listeners or those U.S. bound for the islands to please go to the North Shore and give it a visit. It's really a striking show for sure.
It opens on the 10th, and then it's coming down right after, a day or two after. It may be going up at Turtle Bay. I have a meeting tomorrow, so it may be shown at Turtle Bay Hotel for 2 weeks over, you know, from the 12th until the 1st of January, and then it goes back to Pipeline Gallery for the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks of January. But there will be images that are there throughout the month. It's just not going to be the entire gallery until January 1st.
And how many total images for the opening are you going to have?
It depends on how many we can fit in there when we get there. I think there's 15 to 18, something like that, that are going to probably go up. There's definitely 15 solid.
And in for this particular style, will this be behind glass, or are they going to be...
It was printed on canvas, and it's being hung in bamboo because I wanted it to somewhat feel organic. And there's also an addition that's going up in frames and floated in glass. So there's options depending on, because it's all been limited editioned.
How long did this project take from when you first started taking test shots to the opening?
It's been 2.5 years.
You mentioned before that this is not something, this isn't a paid gig, this is a labor of love for the two of you. What does this show mean to you on a personal level to see this through? For you, Kirk, as a photographer, what is it about this show that kept you going with it, that made you want to see it through and see this project hung?
You know, it's obviously something that we spend a lot of time thinking about and a lot of time putting together and going back and forth and, you know, what works and what doesn't. And, you know, we spoke with Kanoe about what images she thought worked, and that's why we ended up, you know, sticking to the Kahiko, because I do have a lot of the Awana that no one's seen yet. And, you know, for me, I'd really like to keep the project going. You know, as Siobhan said earlier, it's all of this started with men, and I would love to be able to shoot men and get the men's side of hula and be able to show that. And it's something that I would like to, you know, I shot a bunch of landscapes with in conjunction with this, because I feel like it sort of is out of context without showing some side of the islands. And you know, I'd like to be able to continue shooting the landscapes, and I'd like to be able to shoot the men, and I'd like, you know, anyone who is interested in sharing it, you know, I don't want to say that it's over right now. It's something that I'd like to continue. That's why it's sort of called the Hula Project. I'm hoping that it's not, this is just over and done with at this point.
And Siobhan, do you want to have any closing thoughts on seeing this now actually on the wall in Hawaii?
I mean, it's thrilling for me. You know, they always say you can take the girl out of the islands, but you can't take the islands out of the girl. And so to be able to share one of my greatest loves, you know, from childhood with my husband, and to be able to collaborate with him is quite an honor. And I mean, I think that I couldn't imagine a better photographer for the project, primarily because of Kirk's profound respect for his subjects, and it shows in his work. I think not only does he just creatively have an amazing eye, which lends itself to the art of Hawaiian or of hula, but I think he allows, rather than sort of imposing his interpretations, he sort of allows the dancer, the art, the culture, the history, all of that to sort of speak for itself. And he, like the rest of us, you know, are basically witnesses, you know, to something amazing. And so it's so exciting for me to be able to not only work on the project with him, but now to be able to share it with, you know, my friends and family back home, and hopefully to be able to take this on a tour and, you know, share what we call the Aloha spirit with everyone else, you know, worldwide. So it's great that we're finally at this point.
That was Kirk and Siobhan Edwards. Talking Paper interviews like this one are part of a great Thursday lineup of shows for what is now season 4 of Radio Free Brooklyn. So help us keep bringing those shows to you by giving to our Patreon at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. You can give as much as you'd like and get free perks in return. The second half of this episode features an interview with Oakland, California-based poet Alexandra Naughton, who is very involved in Oakland's creative community. She performs her own work and organizes readings for others. In the past, she has collaborated on events with J.K. Fowler, founder of literary nonprofit Nomadic Press. She also runs her own zine and small press, Be About It, and her debut novel, American Mary, came out in early 2016. I began our interview by asking Alexandra to tell the story of Be About It.
So Be About It started as a zine that I made back in 2010, and I basically just wanted to see if I could put together a magazine of my own. I had read a book by Ariel Gore called How to Be a Famous Writer Before You're Dead, and I never really thought of myself as a writer or like a poet or anything, even like I've been reading and writing poetry since I was like a little kid. But something happened when I was unemployed. I just decided, like, I had my calling, you know? The church was calling me, but the church was writing and, you know, making these small little books. I just used my blog as a platform to see if I could get submissions from people who I knew who wrote. And also I asked friends, and I made a little magazine. And it's something I had always wanted to do. But, like, if you try to do it with other people, it's kind of hard to get them to be as motivated as you are. So, I don't know, I just did it myself and have been doing it myself pretty much since then. I've had help. People have helped me do, like, the art design or whatever, but it's usually just me slapping it together.
Was there, any kind of theme or philosophy to the works that you published in Be About It?
Mostly it's just people who are, you know, trying to do something interesting and aren't necessarily getting attention for it. I like quirky, weird little poems and like arts and craftsy type stuff. Not necessarily arts and craftsy, but just like funky, not necessarily scholarly. I guess I have an aesthetic. I can't really explain it or describe it. But my friend Jesse, he and I have been taking Be About It to a different direction, like trying to branch out and get more people involved using like social media or whatever. And he's been spearheading the social media campaign. But we just like to joke that we're both assholes and we like trash. So that's what Be About It is. It's just trash.
Can you compare the paper version of Be About It to, say, the digital experience of it?
The paper version is my little baby. It's something that I only do twice a year because it's just, you know, it's like a week of copy pasting stuff and making sure everything's formatted correctly. And so I only do that twice a year. But Jesse was in school and needed a internship. And I was like, oh, do you want to be a Be About It intern? So he got class credit for working on Be About It and decided he wanted to do a monthly prompt. So he kind of took care of that and was getting people to submit for prompts that he would come up with. It's definitely a different experience. The zine is just kind of what I think, and online is more Jesse.
Let's talk about places you might be able to find not just the zine, but other independently published books in the Oakland area. Oakland, especially in and around, say, the Fruitvale section or other sections like that. It's known for a lot of really interesting independent bookstores. I've been to one called Issues. You have a continuing relationship with one called Wolfman Books.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Wolfman is great. Justin Carter, it's his shop. He's super passionate about the literature scene and, you know, involving people and letting people use his space to put on shows and get the community involved in readings and musical events. So he's been great in just allowing Be About It to use his space for free. And bless his heart. Like, I always feel so annoying when I'm, like, setting up a show there. I always feel like I'm in his hair. But he's, like, the nicest guy. So it's just me being paranoid, probably. But I always feel like I'm driving him nuts. I wish, like, I could, like, donate money to Wolfman or something like that. Like, give them an endowment because they've just been so great. And the way that I knew about Wolfman was because I got assigned them as a place to have the Beast Crawl reading back in 2014. That was the first time I did a Beast Crawl. Beast Crawl is this huge thing in Oakland. It's like a bunch of different bookstores and bars. It's like a bar crawl event, but there's a different reading in every event location. You can hop from one to the other. Be About It got assigned Wolfman as the venue, and we've kind of just developed that relationship since then.
And another relationship you had, even though you guys haven't done stuff lately, there was for a time something that you did with Josh Fowler over at Nomadic Press. Tell me about that.
So we had Be Live About It, our variety show. It was a really good idea. I think, you know, I feel like it's hard to get a mixed crowd to a poetry reading unless, like, a lot of people just do not want to go to a poetry reading, and I feel like they just don't like the idea of it. But if they actually went, they would probably have fun, especially if they went to one of my events, because my events are fun. They're more like parties than they are like readings. It's not like some freaking guy standing up there for like 45 minutes reading some horrible, boring sonnet. Like, they're fun, like fun poems, usually pretty funny. Like, I like to pick people who are, you know, got a sense of humor and short and sweet. I'm not trying to keep you there all night. But I figured if we incorporate a musical act and maybe someone who's a strictly stand-up performer, if we do poetry, stand-up, and music, we can get people from all different spheres to come to this event. And people who don't want to go to a poetry reading but enjoy comedy, they would find out, oh, like, this is actually pretty fun. Some of these poems are actually really funny. And I don't know, just try to get a more diverse audience and get more people involved in the literary scene in Oakland. But I don't know a lot of comedians and I don't know a lot of bands, so it was really hard to, like, find new acts to have every time. Like, we always had a poet. We could always get a poet every month, but finding, like, a new musician or new comedian was just kind of strenuous.
One more question about Wolfman Books. What are your thoughts on the importance of poets, writers continuing to publish in tactile paper form?
I want to say, like, I like holding a book. I like reading a book. There's something special about it to me, and it doesn't hurt my eyes as much as reading a screen does. I feel like when you put out a book, it's more accessible to more people. Books are generally cheaper than, you can go to a library and get it. I don't know. It's like playing a record versus playing a CD or listening to an MP3. It's just a different experience. You know, if you want to read on a Kindle, that's fine. But I definitely prefer to read on paper. Then you can, like, slam a book down when you're finished. You can't really do that when you're reading on the internet or, like, reading on your phone. Yes.
Tell me about American Mary first.
It's something that I guess I was writing for years without really realizing it. And then not even like writing it, but something that was just, it's been marinating in my mind for years. And then I started writing stories and then started putting the stories together in a sort of narrative. I hate when people ask me what it's about. My bag got searched at the airport going through Oakland airport security. And I had like an eighth of an ounce of weed. And I was like, oh God, like, you're allowed to fly through Oakland with weed. But I just thought he would say something. I have a medical marijuana card, so it was legal for me. But he was going through my bag, like, tearing up all my clothes. And then he pulled out the book and he was like, oh, whose books are these? And I was like, oh, it's a book I wrote. And he was like, oh, what's it about? And I was like, it's like an existential comedy drama, kind of. It's about, like, nihilism. And he was like, what's nihilism? And I was like, oh, it's like, you know, it's the end of the world, but you don't really care. Like, I don't know. I hate describing this, but I like it when other people tell me what it's about, because I feel like that's what it is to you. Like, that's interesting and that's valid. What it is to me doesn't really matter because I already wrote the freaking book. So I'd rather have other people tell me what it is.
So let's hear a portion.
Okay. We owned a haunted house, an attraction of sorts. Maybe you would call it a tourist trap. But we lived there, too. We spent our days repairing leaky ceilings and raking dead leaves. Homemade bread and jam. taking turns with the chores, but we knew our place. I liked the quiet, and you liked the cold. Arms locked, we took people on tours of the grounds. Some said it felt like the strangers on a train amusement park. Body of water, islands, scattered woods perfect for choking, and pale brown fields stretching over hills and disappearing into dusk. It scared me at night, but you held my hand. One evening while crossing the woods, we came across a huddled form. A red-haired hag drinking the blood of a male wolf to restore her looks. As she lapped, the wrinkles fell from her neck. "Don't tell my husband," she said, stroking the wolf's fur, but we kept walking, quickening our pace. You put your hand on the small of my back and left it there, guiding me along trails and helping me avoid tree roots underfoot all the way home. And that was the last significant thing that happened to us before I decided to leave.
In terms of putting America and Mary together, all the work that was drawn in to make it, is this the work of, are we talking years?
Yeah, definitely. Like, at least a year and a half, probably 2 years, maybe more than that, if you count just like thinking about some of the stories I was writing.
Let's compare that to I Wish You Had Never Emailed Me.
Yeah. I wrote that in a day, in a notebook, while I was at work, on smoke breaks, when I was still smoking cigarettes. I went out and like wrote pretty much half the book while smoking cigarettes outside in front of my office. Yeah, that was a quick one. I feel like another book I put out, the Lana Del Rey book, was similar. Like, I wrote that in a day.
And this falls under the micro chapbook format?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So a micro chapbook, I had never even heard of it. Like, I know what a chapbook is. It's like a staple-bound little book. But a micro chapbook's even shorter than that, 20 pages or fewer. And there was a contest, Go City Press. I wasn't even thinking about writing this book, but I had ideas in my head. And someone who I'd met in Los Angeles, Jordan Hoxie, sent me a message saying, "Hey, I'm helping out with Go City Press. You should definitely try to submit a micro chapbook for this contest." And I was like, "Oh, okay, whatever." But then I got super emotional about something and like decided to write down this stuff, and it became this little narrative, which was a little micro chapbook.
And is this something that's also paper and digital, or just digital?
It's just digital. My dad told me he bought it and then he printed it out so that he could read it. So, I mean, you could do that if you wanted to, but you could donate like 50 cents or a dollar and download it. You could pay what you wish type of donation thing.
You're currently in New York City. You came up today from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You're going to be reading at Molasses Books. Tell me about that reading.
I think I'm going to do a performance with the music of Jason Molina, Magnolia Electric Co., Songs Ohio. Do you know these bands? Mm-hmm. Jason Molina is like the genius behind it all. I don't know. I got obsessed with him and his different stuff. So I'm going to perform a piece over a Magnolia Electric Co. song. Or actually, I think it's the Songs Ohio, whatever. It's called Almost Was Good Enough. And I did it when I did a performance in Marin. I did it another time for something in Oakland, but I'm going to do it again because it's one of my favorite things to do. And I like reading over music. I feel like it adds something extra that not a lot of people get to see. I don't know.
Quick side question, yeah, before we continue. Do you have any other favorite poets or writers who do that same thing, who employ music as part of their acts?
There's a few people who I admire who recite their poetry, which I try to do sometimes. I have a few stories in here that I have memorized. That always adds something extra to the performance if you can have it down without looking at a piece of paper. Does anybody else perform with music? Oh, yeah. Zarina Zabrinsky totally does. And I don't know. She's fabulous. She's this nutty Ukrainian woman who is very, very dramatic. And I want to be like her sometimes. She's very interesting.
You're listening to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. Let's get back to your fellow poets who you're reading with at Molasses. One is known to me, Abigail Wellhouse. I'm familiar with her Bad Baby chapbook. Excellent read. Who else are you reading with?
reading with Nadia DeVry, who is from Amsterdam. And there's some other people that I am not familiar with who are also on the bill, but...
This is kind of a reunion, though, for the three of you.
Yeah, the three of us, we read together at AWP over the springtime in Los Angeles. That was a really fun reading, but it was a weird reading. So Nadia set up that reading. She set up this one. But the deal with the last reading was we had to share the space with a writer's group or like a workshop group or like an open mic group or something. And we did our stuff first. There were like four of us. We all read early on in the evening. And then it was the workshop open mic night thing. And the guy who ran that was super pissed at us because we left. We didn't stick. Some of us stuck around for the open mic, but strategically, like, we would leave this cafe like one by one just because it was like, oh, it's just like a bunch of people bitching and like just not good poetry. So I don't know. Hopefully this night is going to be better. We don't have to share the stage with an open mic night.
An example of an even more intimate show is something that you're doing down in Philadelphia. You're reading at a house.
Yeah, I'm reading at a house. My friend Jenny Ryder put that on for me, and I think that's going to be really fun. Shai Watson's reading. Amelia Picciarella's reading. A few other people from Philly are going to read. So that should be cute. I've never been to her house, so we'll see what it's like. I'm sure it's going to be very adorable. I like reading people's houses because it's more casual. You're not worried about like upsetting the proprietor of the venue if you like do something that's a little weird or say something that's a little weird.
And I've talked to poets before who even are happy to not have to read from a stage of any kind. The fact that they're maybe even on the same level as their audience.
Yeah, I think there's something extremely intimate about that. I kind of like being on stage. I feel like when I perform, it's like I'm inhabiting this persona, and being on stage is kind of like giving that persona space to like not be me, to be somebody else. And like, this is clearly a performance. I'm not just, you know, reading you my diary. Like here, this is something that is made up, or this is something that's a work of fiction by me.
As someone who organizes events and works with poets and stuff, do you find that disconnect often of people, say, who are very good on paper but are not good performers, or vice versa?
Yeah, I feel like being a good writer doesn't mean that you're going to be able to read your work well. A lot of people can't. A lot of people are just, it's like, you should hire an actor. Like, no offense, but this is really just like, I don't want to sit through this. I'm sorry. It goes the same the other way too. Like, if you're, some people are like very theatrical and they're good at reading other people's work, but they can't produce that type of stuff for themselves.
And do you read your work always, or do you have any memorized?
Yeah, some memorized, yeah. I have a story in here that I like recited it from memory because my friend was mad at me and like wanted to hear a story, and I didn't have anything to read from, so I just like tried to recreate this story from what I remembered. And I've read it so many times, and like it's kind of like music, like a song, you know the right time to sing certain words or whatever. Like, it's, you know, it's, you've got a flow down, so you kind of can anticipate what line comes next. So I just recited it from memory, like 3 o'clock in the morning, really exhausted after having this long argument with my friend.
Would you mind reading that?
Sunken islands, we are living on sunken islands. Well, they feel sunken, like hungover eyes all peeping only slightly because it's straining. Like, there isn't much space to move around in. Like, the way you act when we're in public together. There's no green anything. I can see the Statue of Liberty from my Philly window, Manhattan's metallic cones hundreds of stories high like quills jutting, a beastly back and head submerged like it can't deal anymore, smack needles in sidewalk cracks. I guess I always wanted to live in the big city. All those offices. Fuck.
This brings up a good question, because what I wanted to shift now to is Oakland itself.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about some of the things in Oakland that inspire you poetically, or anywhere in the East Bay.
I live in Richmond, right, which is north of Berkeley. It's not necessarily the suburbs, but it feels more suburban than parts of Oakland do. And it's quiet, and there's flowers, and, you know, people have nice yards, people take care of their houses. It's, you know, kind of picturesque. So I like to walk around there and kind of imagine what it's like to live in the different suburban houses and like what kind of people live in there. And you know, how they live their daily lives and like what are they worried about. And I don't know, like riding my bike around the East Bay, I got inspired just, I don't know, I like landscapes. I like looking at, I guess what I really like looking at people's houses. That's what I've always really, like, it's so romantic to me to like look into people's windows and like, especially when you're outside and you've been out for a while. Oh, I wish I could go in there and like, you know, looks like they're having tea or something like that, like warm yellow lights. Try to imagine how those people are spending their evenings.
San Francisco and parts of Oakland and all in and around the Bay have a unique, I guess going back to the stuff that survived the earthquake, Victorian era architecture that is really renowned for its beauty and its aesthetics. When you travel to places, let's say like Fruitvale, it has beautiful architecture. It also has one-story, very pragmatic architecture as mm-hmm. well. What are your thoughts about that? These neighborhoods where you have a mix of neighborhoods that are both aesthetically beautiful, but then also pragmatically simple.
I feel like I'm more drawn to the ones that are pragmatically simple, like poured concrete buildings. Like, this building is not necessarily pragmatically simple, but it's industrial kind of. I like that. Like, it's, you know what this building's for. It's not like, Victorians are pretty or whatever, but they've got so many like nooks and crannies. You feel like there's probably cobwebs all over the place. And
yeah, 475 Kent Avenue is about 100 years old now. And it, from what they tell me, the type of concrete that was used only reached its peak strength 100 years after it was poured.
Oh, wow. So it was curing all that time?
That whole time. At the same time, though, in its current incarnation, has only been 15 or 20 years as the apartments. But even if you walk around, you see the old anchorage points and holes and all this other stuff for long ago industry and things like that. The impression I got when I was going out to Oakland, the in terms of the industrial side of the town, is mm-hmm. obviously going by the ports. Mm-hmm. And there's these the huge cranes that you see in the distance and in that side there. Has any of that stuff ever made its way into inspiring any of your work?
I don't think I've ever referenced the cranes or whatever, but it's like you're living in it. So you kind of, it gets absorbed into you somehow, right? Just being in those environments becomes part of like part of my dreamscapes, you know?
I'd like to close with this because it's something that the rest of the country hears so often about, is that across the Bay in San Francisco, the cost of living just seems to continue to rise.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that bleeds over to Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
You're part of an extended creative community in Oakland. What's that like now as in the throes of development and, say, rising rents? And what's the impact been on your community?
It's, like, really annoying. And people are mad. I'm mad. I can't live in Oakland anymore. I can't live in SF. Couldn't live in SF if I tried. Like, I mean, I guess I could, but it would be really uncomfortable living conditions. Like, I can't live the way I live right now in Oakland. Like, I have a studio apartment in Richmond. I couldn't find something like that for the price that I'm paying in Oakland or Berkeley or SF. God, I could live under someone's freaking couch or like live in a closet. Like, people are actually living in closets, and it's totally diluting the culture, and I'm like ready to leave, kind of. Like, you know, JK's been great and like kind of revitalizing the East Bay community for poets, but it feels like anytime I'm out, just like all these, I'm surrounded by all these vapid people who like just want to talk about Tesla, and that's cool if you want to talk about like your startup or whatever, but it's just not that interesting to me. And
so you've definitely noticed a rise in tech industry people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And like
even at the readings that you organize.
Oh no, people don't come to readings. But I did perform at this event in San Francisco in like January 2015 or January 2014. I don't remember. But it was very strange, and most of the people in the audience were from the tech crowd or from, like, the Burning Man crowd. And I read there with Sarah Griff. She was the only other poet that I knew who performed at this thing, and it was, like, a variety show with comedy and stuff like that, but it wasn't very good. And the people who were hosting the show made this, like, horrible joke about Sarah's ethnicity and, like, we just kind of felt like we were like performing monkeys for like these tech people, and just like, ugh, like I don't want to be the court jester for this new ruling class. Like I'm not interested in that. I'd rather freaking move to Laramie, Wyoming, or whatever. And I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm thinking about getting an MFA. let's just end it there. I'm thinking about joining an MFA program because I'm so sick. I mean, I love California. I love the Bay Area. I love so much about it. But I don't know. I'm kind of over it. You guys can have it.
Just to close, mm-hmm. could I hear one more portion from American Mary, your choice?
It kind of sucks when you realize you're living in a Lori Moore story. Like, it's kind of shitty when you think almost everyone wants to fuck you. I'm not even talking about sex, really. There's always at least two types of boys. Two types, at least two boys, lurking and waiting and wanting. And you like that they want you, but it's not really what you want. But, like, what else do you have going on? It's nice to have people to go to parties with, and you don't really need it or want it, but you slip up sometimes. It's easier to know things if someone else is witnessing. And it seems nice to be desired and obsessed over. And sometimes in your head, you're being lifted above crowds, carried down the sidewalk so you can get an almond milk latte with an added shot, like you're the VIP of this coffee shop and everywhere else. But in real life, it's totally unsatisfying to be worshipped. Like feeding a sinkhole. Like you will never be satiated. Like I want you to want me, but more than that, I want me to want you. And it's upsetting because you feel greedy and unethical and think you have to choose at some point, make any kind of decision, but also probably not. And you like catering to and filling someone else's void, but you can't let anyone have everything. So you let separate ideas roll around in your head, bowling pins spinning and clunking. And it's all completely pointless because they're all really bad for you in their own special ways. And you know it, but you don't really care about it until it becomes a problem. One is always cheap and greasy, like processed meats, like hot dogs, but you know he'll love you forever like a pet if you keep rewarding him. There's a lot like that one. It's a steady type. Modern archetypes of everything fast and easy, they're always around, this pork roll type, and though they're predictable, you don't really know what to do with them. You keep them around because you love to entertain and be pleasing, but it's not really what you want. It's the other one. It's always the other one. The other one is always in love with someone else, but enjoys your body violently and excites you most because he only responds sometimes. He's over-the-counter drugs. He's blacking out and getting a motel room with you, throwing you down onto a carpet that hasn't been vacuumed in months, maybe years. He's getting what he wants out of you and then leaving you to sit on a string until it hurts too much. So you decide to get up and walk away for good, or until the next time he calls. They're both going to kill you, and probably just as quickly.
That's from American Mary by Alexandra Naughton. Alexandra, thank you for being on Talking Paper.
Thank you for having me.
You can read more of Alexandra's work and also watch a wide variety of performance videos at her website, thezaritza.tumblr.com. That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.